Hugh lacquered to her forehead with sweat. A woman's come in. She's pretty far along. Just a second. Sarah gave Murray a firm look. No more nonsense. Are we clear on this? Fine, the woman huffed. Have it your way. Sarah followed Jenny to admissions, where the new woman lay on a gurney, her husband standing beside her holding her hand. She was older than the patients Sarah was used to seeing, maybe 40, with a drawn, hard face and crowded teeth. Shocks of gray ran through her long, damp hair. Sarah quickly read her chart. Mrs. Jimenez, I'm Dr. Wilson. You're 36 weeks along, is that correct?
I'm not sure. About that.
How long have you been bleeding?
A few days.
Just spotting. But then this morning it got worse, and I started to hurt. I told her she should have come sooner, her husband explained. He was a large man in dark blue coveralls. His hands were big as bear paws. I was at work. Sarah checked the woman's heart rate and blood pressure, then drew up the gown and placed her hands on her belly, gently pressing. The woman winced in pain. Sarah moved her hands lower, touching here and there, searching for the site of the abruption. That was when she noticed the two boys, young teenagers, sitting off to the side. She exchanged a look with the man, but said nothing.
"We have a birthright certificate," the man said nervously.
"Let's not worry about that now." From the pocket of her coat, Sarah withdrew the fetoscope and pressed the silver disc against the woman's abdomen, holding up a hand for silence. A strong, swishing click filled her ears. She recorded the baby's heart rate on the chart, 118 beats per minute. A little low, but nothing too concerning yet.
"Okay, Jenny, let's get her into the OR." She turned to the woman's husband. "Mr. Jimenez?
Carlos. That's my first name.
Carlos, everything's going to be fine, but you'll want your children to wait here."
The placenta had separated from the uterine wall. That's where the blood was coming from. The tear might clot on its own, but the fact that the baby was in a breech position complicated matters for a vaginal delivery, and at 36 weeks, Sarah saw no reason to wait. In the hall outside the OR, she explained what she intended to do.
"We could hold off," she told the woman's husband, "but I don't think that's wise. The baby might not be getting enough oxygen."
"Can I stay with her?"
"Not for this."
She took the man by the arm and looked him in the eye.
"I'll take care of her.
Trust me. There'll be lots for you to do later." Sarah called for the anesthetic and a warmer while she and Jenny washed up and put on their gowns. Jenny cleaned the woman's belly and pubic area with iodine and bound her to the table. Sarah rolled lights into place, snapped on her gloves, and poured the anesthetic into a small dish. Using forceps, she dipped a sponge into the brown liquid, then placed this into the compartment of the breathing mask.
"Okay, Mrs. Jimenez," she said. "I'm going to put this on your face now. It will smell a little strange."
The woman looked at her with helpless terror.
"Is this going to hurt?"
Sarah smiled to reassure her.
"Believe me, you won't care. And when you wake up, your baby will be here."
She positioned the breather on the woman's face.
"Just take slow, even breaths."
The woman was out like a light. Sarah rolled the tray of instruments, still warm from the boiler, into place and drew up her mask. With a scalpel, she cut a transverse incision at the top of the woman's pubic bone, then a second to open the uterus. The baby appeared, coiled head down in the amniotic sac, its fluid tinged pink with blood. Sarah carefully punctured the sac and reached inside with forceps.
"Okay, get ready."
Jenny moved beside her with a towel and a basin. Sarah drew the baby through the incision, sliding her hand beneath its head as it emerged and hooking her thumb and pinky beneath its shoulders.
Her arms. The baby was a girl.
One more slow pull and she came free. Holding her in the towel, Jenny suctioned her mouth and nose, rolled her onto her stomach and rubbed her back. With a wet hiccup, the child began to breathe. Sarah clamped the umbilicus, snipped it with a pair of shears,
drew out the placenta and dropped it into the basin. While Jenny put the baby in the warmer and checked her vitals, Sarah sutured the woman's incisions. Minimal blood, no complications. A healthy baby. Not bad for 10 minutes' work. Sarah drew the mask off the woman's face.
"She's here," she whispered into her ear. "Everything's fine. She's a healthy baby girl."
Her husband and sons were waiting outside. Sarah gave everyone a moment together. Carlos kissed his wife, who had begun to come around, then lifted the baby from the warmer to hold her. Each of the sons took a turn.
"Do you have a name for her?" Sarah asked.
The man nodded, his eyes shining with tears. Sarah liked him for this. Not all the fathers were so sentimental. Some seemed barely to care.
"Grace," he said.
Mother and daughter were wheeled down the hall. The man sent his boys away, then reached into the pocket of his jumpsuit and nervously handed Sarah the piece of paper she was expecting. Couples who were going to have a third baby were allowed to purchase the right to do so from a couple who had had fewer than their legal allotment. Sarah disliked the practice. It seemed wrong to her, buying and selling the rights to making a person, and half the certificates she saw were forgeries, purchased on the trade. She examined Carlos's document. The paper was government-issue stock, but the ink wasn't even close to the correct color, and the seal had been embossed on the wrong side. "Whoever sold you this, you should get your money back." Carlos's face collapsed.
"Please. I'm just a hydro. I don't have enough to pay the tax. It was totally my fault. She said it wasn't the right day."
"Good of you to admit, but I'm afraid that's not the issue."
"I'm begging you, Dr. Wilson. Don't make us give her to the sisters. My sons are good boys. You can see that."
Sarah had no intention of sending baby Grace to the orphanage. On the other hand, the man's certificate was so palpably false that somebody in the census office was bound to flag it.
"Do us both a favor and get rid of this. I'll record the birth, and if the paperwork bounces back, I'll make something up. Tell them I lost it or something. With any luck, it'll get misplaced in the shuffle."
Carlos made no move to accept the certificate. He seemed not to comprehend what Sarah was telling him. She had no doubt that he had mentally rehearsed this moment 1,000 times. Not once, in all that time, had he imagined that somebody would simply make his problem go away.
"Go on. Take it." "You'd really do that? Won't you get in trouble?"
She pushed the paper toward him.
"Tear it up. Burn it. Shove it in a trash can somewhere. Just forget we had this conversation."
The man returned the certificate to his pocket. For a second, he seemed about to hug her, but stopped himself.
"You'll be in our prayers, Dr. Wilson. We'll give her a good life, I swear.
I'm counting on it. Just do me a favor."
"Anything." "When your wife tells you it's not the right day, believe her, okay?"
At the checkpoint, Sarah showed her pass and made her way home through darkened streets. Except for the hospital and other essential buildings, the electricity was shut off at 2200, which was not to say that the city went to bed the minute the power was cut. In darkness, it acquired a different kind of life. Saloons, brothels, gaming halls. Hollis had told her plenty of stories. And after 2 years in the refugee camp, there wasn't much that Sarah hadn't seen herself. She let herself into the apartment. Kate had long since been put to bed, but Hollis was waiting up, reading a book by candlelight at the kitchen table.
"Anything good?" she asked.
With Sarah working so many late hours at the hospital, Hollis had become quite a reader, checking out armfuls of books from the library and reading them from a stack he kept by his side of the bed. "It's a little heavy on the mumbo-jumbo. Michael recommended it a while ago. It's about a submarine." She hung her coat on the hook by the door.
"What's a submarine?"
Hollis closed the book and removed his reading glasses. Another new development. Little half-moon lenses, cloudy and scratched, set in a black plastic frame. Sarah thought they made him look distinguished, though Hollis said they made him feel old.
Apparently it's a boat that goes underwater. Sounds like bullshit to me, but the story's not bad. Are you hungry? I can fix you something if you want.
She was, but eating felt like too much effort. All I want to do is go to bed. She checked on Kate, who was sound asleep, and washed up at the sink. She paused to examine herself in the mirror. No doubt about it. The years were starting to show. Fans of wrinkles had formed around her eyes. Her blonde hair, which she now wore shorter and pulled back, had thinned somewhat. Her skin was beginning to lose its tightness. She'd always thought of herself as pretty, and in a certain light still was. But sometime in the midst of life, she had passed the apex. In the past, when she'd looked at her reflection, she had still seen the little girl she'd once been. The woman in the mirror had still been an extension of her girlhood self. Now, it was the future she saw. The wrinkles would deepen, her skin would sag, the lights of her eyes would dim. Her youth was fading, easing into the past. And yet this thought did not disturb her, or not very much. With age came authority, and with authority came the power to be useful, to heal and comfort and bring new people into the world. You'll be in our prayers, Dr. Wilson. Sarah heard words like these nearly every day, but she had never become inured to them. Just that name, Dr. Wilson. It still amazed her to hear someone say it and know they were speaking to her. When Sarah had arrived in Kerrville 3 years ago, she'd reported to the hospital to see if her nurse's training could be of any use. In a little windowless room, a doctor by the name of Elakwa quizzed her at length. Bodily systems, diagnostics, treatments for illness and injury. His face showed no emotion as he responded to her answers with marks on a clipboard. The grilling lasted over 2 hours. By its conclusion, Sarah felt like she was stumbling blind in a windstorm. What use could her meager training be to a medical establishment that was so far ahead of the homespun remedies of the colony? How could she have been so naive?
Well, I guess that about covers it, Dr. Elakwa said. Congratulations.
Sarah was knocked flat. Was he being ironic?
Does this mean I can be a nurse? She asked.
A nurse? No. We have plenty of nurses. Report back here tomorrow, Ms. Wilson. Your training starts at 0700 sharp. My guess is 12 months should do it.
Training for what? She asked, and Elakwa, whose lengthy inquisition was a mere shadow of things to come, said with unconcealed impatience,
Perhaps I'm not being clear. I don't know where you learned it, but you know twice as much as you have any right to. You're going to be a doctor.
And then, of course, there was Kate. Their beautiful, amazing, miraculous Kate.
Sarah and Hollis would have liked to have had a second child, but the violence of Kate's birth had inflicted too much damage. A disappointment. And not without irony, as day by day new babies traveled into the world beneath her hands. But Sarah was hardly entitled to complain.
That she should have found her daughter at all, and that the two of them should have been reunited with Hollis and escaped the homeland to travel back to Kerrville to be a family together. Miracle was hardly the word.
Sarah was not religious in the church-going sense. The sisters all struck her as good people, if a bit extreme in their beliefs. But only an idiot would fail to feel the actions of Providence. You couldn't wake up each day in a world like that and not spend a solid hour just thinking of ways to be grateful. She thought rarely of the homeland, or as rarely as she could. She still had dreams about it, though strangely these dreams did not focus on the worst things that had happened to her there. Mostly they were dreams of feeling hungry and cold and helpless, or the endlessly turning wheels of the grinder in the biodiesel plant. Sometimes she was simply looking at her hands with a feeling of perplexity, as if trying to remember something she was supposed to be holding. From time to time she dreamed about Jackie, the old woman who had befriended her. Or else Lila, for whom Sarah's complex feelings had distilled over time to a kind of sorrowful sympathy. Once in a while her dreams were flat-out nightmares. She was carrying Kate in blinding snow, the two of them being chased by something terrible. But these had abated. So that was one more thing to be thankful for. Eventually, perhaps not soon, but someday, the homeland would become just one more memory in a life of memories, an unpleasant recollection that made the others all the sweeter. Hollis was already out cold. The man slept like a fallen giant. His head hit the pillow, and soon he was snoring away. Sarah extinguished the candle and slid beneath the covers. She wondered if Marie had delivered her baby yet, and if she was still yelling at her husband. She thought of the Jimenez family and the look on Carlos's face as he lifted baby Grace into his arms. Maybe Grace was the word she was looking for. It was possible they'd still get flagged by the census office. But Sarah didn't think so. Not with so many babies being born. Which was the thing? That was the heart of the matter. A new world was coming. A new world was already here. Maybe that was what getting older taught you, when you looked in the mirror and saw the passage of time in your face, when you looked at your sleeping daughter and saw the girl you once were and would never be again. The world was real, and you were in it. A brief part, but still a part. And if you were lucky, and maybe even if you weren't, the things you'd done for love would be remembered. 6. The sky over Houston released the night slowly, darkness easing to gray. Greer made his way into the city. Where the Katy Freeway met the 610 in a tangle of collapsed ramps and overpasses, he arced north, away from the bayous and swamps, with their sucking mud and impenetrable foliage, bypassing the liquefied inner neighborhoods for higher ground, then followed a wide avenue of junked cars south to the downtown lagoon. The rowboat was where he'd left it 2 months ago. Greer tied up his horse, dumped out the mosquito-infested rainwater, and dragged the craft to the water's edge. Across the lagoon, the Chevron Mariner lay at its improbable angle, a great temple of rust and rot lodged among the listing towers of the city's central core. He laid his supplies in the bottom of the boat, set it afloat, and rowed away from shore. In the lobby of One Allen Center, he tied off at the base of the escalators and descended, the duffel bag with its sloshing contents slung over his shoulder. The 10-story climb through mold-befouled air left him dizzy and short of breath. In the empty office, he pulled up the rope he'd left in place and lowered the bag to the deck of the Mariner, then climbed down behind it. He always fed Carter first. On the port side, just about amidships, a hatch lay flush with the deck. Greer knelt beside it and removed the jugs of blood from the bag. He tied three together by their handles with one of the ropes. The sun was angled behind him, raking the deck with light. With a heavy wrench, he unscrewed the safety bolts, turned the handle, and opened the hatch. A shaft of sunshine spilled into the space below. Carter lay curled in a fetal position near the forward bulkhead, his body in shadow away from the light. Old jugs and coils of rope were piled in a heap on the floor. Hand over hand, Greer lowered the jugs. Only when they reached bottom did Carter stir. As he scuttled on all fours toward the blood, Greer released the rope, closed the hatch, and replaced the safety bolts. Now, Amy. Greer moved to the second hatch. The trick was to move fast, but not with panicked recklessness. The scent of blood. For Amy, it could not be contained by something as meager as the thin plastic membrane of the jugs. Her hunger was too strong. Greer set his supplies within quick reach, unwrenched the bolts, and placed them to the side. A deep breath to calm his nerves. Then he opened the hatch. Blood. She leapt. Lucius dropped the jugs, slammed the hatch, and shoved the first bolt into place as Amy's body made contact. The metal clanged as if hit by a giant hammer. He threw his body across it. Another blow came, knocking the wind from his chest. The hinges were bending. Unless he could get the remaining bolts in place, the hatch wouldn't hold. He'd managed to get two more into their holes when Amy struck again. Greer watched helplessly as one of the bolts jogged free and rolled across the deck. His hand stabbed outward and seized it at the very edge of his reach. "Amy," he yelled. "It's me. It's Lucius." He shoved the bolt into place and smacked it with the head of the wrench, driving it home. "The blood is there! Follow the scent of the blood!" 3 turns on the wrench and the bolt locked down, bringing the fourth hole back into alignment. He rammed its bolt into place. 1 last pound on the underside of the hatch, half-hearted. Then it was over. "Lucius, I didn't mean it." "It's all right," he said.
"I'm sorry."
He picked up his tools and put them in the empty duffel. Below him, in the hold of the Chevron Mariner, Amy and Carter were drinking their fills. It always happened like this. Greer should have been used to it by now. Yet his heart was pounding, his mind and body flying with adrenaline.
"I'm yours, Amy," he said. "I always will be. Whatever comes, you know that."
And with these words, Lucius made his way across the deck of the Mariner and climbed back through the window. 7. Amy returned to awareness to find herself on all fours in the dirt. Her hands were gloved. A plastic flat of impatience rested on the ground close by, and beside it, a rusty trowel.
"You all right there, Miss Amy?"
Carter was sitting on the patio, legs akimbo beneath the wrought iron table, fanning his face with his big straw hat. On the table were 2 glasses of iced tea.
"That man takes good care of us," he said, and sighed with satisfaction. "Haven't eaten my fill like that since I don't remember when."
Amy rose unsteadily to her feet. A deep lassitude enveloped her, as if she had just awoken from a long nap.
"Come and sit a minute," Carter said. "Give the body a chance to digest. Feeding day like a day off round here. Them flowers can wait."
Which was true. There were always more flowers. As soon as Amy finished planting a flat, a new one would appear by the gate. It was the same with the tea. 1 minute the table was bare. In the next, 2 sweating glasses awaited. By what unseen agency these things arrived, Amy did not know. It was all part of this place, and its own particular logic. Every day a season, every season a year. She removed her gloves and crossed the lawn to sit across from Carter. The greasy taste of blood lingered in her mouth. She sipped the tea to clear it away.
"It's good to keep your strength up, Miss Amy," Carter said. "Ain't no prize for starving yourself."
"I just don't like it." She looked at Carter, who was still fanning himself with his hat. "I tried to kill him again."
"Lucius knows the situation well enough. I doubt he takes it personal."
"That's not the point, Anthony. I need to learn to control it the way you do." Carter frowned. He was a man of compact expression, small gestures, thoughtful pauses.
"Don't be so hard on yourself. You ain't had but 3 years to get used to things. You still just a baby in the way of being what we are."
I don't feel like a baby.
What you feel like, then?
A monster.
She'd spoken too sharply. She glanced away, feeling ashamed. After feeding, she always passed through a period of doubt. How strange it all was. She was a body in a ship, but her mind lived here, with Carter, among the plants and flowers. Only when Lucius brought the blood did these two worlds touch each other, and the contrast was disorienting. Carter had explained that this place was nothing particular to the two of them. The difference was that they could see it. There was one world of flesh and blood and bone, but also another, a deeper reality that ordinary people could glimpse only fleetingly, if at all. A world of souls, both the living and the dead, in which time and space, memory and desire existed in a purely fluid state, the way they did in dreams. Amy knew this to be so. She felt as if she'd always known it, that even as a little girl, a purely human girl, she had sensed the existence of this other realm, this world behind the world, as she had come to call it. She supposed that many children did the same. What was childhood if not a passage from light to dark, of the soul's slow drowning in an ocean of ordinary matter? During her time in the Chevron Mariner, a great deal of the past had become clear. Vivid recollections had inched their way back to her, approaching on memory's delicate feet, until things that had happened ages past felt like recent occurrences. She recalled a time, long ago, in the innocent period she thought of as before, before Lacey and Walgast, before Project Noah, before the Oregon mountaintop where they had made their home, and then her long solo wanderings in a peopleless world with only the virals for company, when animals had spoken to her. Larger animals, like dogs, but also smaller ones that nobody paid attention to. Birds, and even insects. She'd thought nothing of this at the time. It was simply the way things were. Nor did it trouble her that nobody else seemed to hear them. It was part of the world's arrangement that the animals spoke only to her, always addressing her by name, as if they were old friends, telling her stories about their lives. And it made her happy to be the recipient of the special gift of their attention, when so much else in her life seemed to make no sense at all. Her mother's lurching emotions and long absences, their drifting from place to place, the strangers that came and went with no apparent purpose. All this had gone on without repercussion until the day Lacey had taken her to the zoo. At the time, Amy did not yet fully comprehend that her mother had deserted her, that she would never see the woman again. And she'd welcomed the invitation. She'd heard of zoos, but had never been to one. She entered the grounds to an animal buzz of welcome. After the confusing events of the previous day, her mother's abrupt departure and the presence of the nuns, who were nice but in a slightly stilted way, as if they were reciting their kindnesses off a card of instructions. Here was a familiar comfort. In a burst of energy, she broke away from Lacey and dashed to the polar bear tank. Three were basking in the sun. A fourth was swimming under the water. How magnificent they were! How amazing! Even now, so many years later, it gave her pleasure to remember them. Their wonderful white fur and great muscular bodies and expressive faces, which seemed to contain all the wisdom of the universe. As Amy approached the glass, the one in the water paddled toward her. Though she knew that her communication with the creatures of the natural world was best conducted in private, her excitement could not be contained. She felt suddenly sorry that such a stately creature should be forced to live like a prisoner, sunning himself on phony rocks and being gawked at by people who did not appreciate him. "What's your name?" she asked the bear. "I'm Amy." His answer was a collision of incompatible consonants, as were the names of the other bears, which he courteously offered.
Were these things real? Had she, a little girl, simply imagined them? But no. All of it had happened, she believed, precisely as she recalled. As she stood at the glass, Lacey came up beside her. She was wearing a look of deep concern.
"There now, Amy," Lacey advised. "Not so close." To put her unease at bay, and because Amy had detected in this kindly woman with her melodious accent an openness to extraordinary phenomena, the zoo, after all, had been her idea, she explained the situation as simply as she knew how. "He has a bear name," she told Lacey. "It's something I can't pronounce." Lacey frowned. "The bear has a name?"
"Of course he does," said Amy. She returned her attention to her new friend, who was bumping his nose against the glass. Amy was about to ask him about his life, if he missed his Arctic home, when the water was rocked by a tremendous splash. A second bear had leapt into the tank. With paws big as hubcaps, he swam toward her, taking his place beside the first bear, who was licking the glass with his immense pink tongue. A collective exhalation of oohs and ahs ascended from the crowd. People began to snap pictures. Amy placed her hand against the glass in greeting. But something felt wrong. Something was different, and it wasn't very good. The bear's great black eyes seemed to be looking not at her but through her, with a gaze of such intensity that she could not look away. She felt herself dissolving into it, as if she were melting, and with this came a falling sensation, like putting her foot on a step that wasn't there. "Amy," the bears were saying. "You're Amy, 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 Amy." Things were happening. Some sort of commotion. As Amy's awareness widened, she became conscious of other sounds, other voices, coming from all around. Not human, but animal. The hoots of monkeys, the shrieks of birds, the roars of jungle cats, and the concussing hooves of elephants and rhinoceroses stamping the ground in panic. As the third and then the fourth bear leapt into the tank, displacing its contents with their white-furred tonnage, a wall of frigid water bulged over the lip. It crashed down upon the crowd, unleashing mayhem. "It's her, it's her, it's her, it's her." She was kneeling by the glass, soaked to the bone, her head bowed to its slick surface. Her mind swirled with the voices, a chorus of black tread. She felt as if the universe were bending around her, swathing her in darkness. They would die, all these animals. That is what her presence meant to them. The bears and monkeys and birds and elephants, all of them. Some would starve in their cages, others would perish by more violent means. Death would take them all. And not just the animals. The people, too. The world would die around her, and she would be left standing at the center, alone. "It's coming. Death is coming. You're Amy, Amy, Amy." "You remembering, ain't you?" Amy's mind returned to the patio. Carter was looking at her pointedly. "I'm sorry," she said. "I didn't mean to snap at you."
"It's all right. I felt the same there at the beginning. Took some getting used to."
The feeling of summer had faded. Autumn would soon come. In the blue-green water of the pool, the body of Rachel Wood would rise. Sometimes, when Amy was tending flowers near the gate, she would see the woman's black Denali slowly cruising past. Through the tinted windows, she could make out Rachel in her tennis clothes, staring at the house. But the car never stopped, and when Amy waved at her, the woman never waved back.
"How much longer do you think we have to wait?"
"That depends on Zero. Man got to show his hand sooner or later. So far as he knows, I'm gone with the rest of them."
"It was the water," Carter had explained, "that protected them. Its cold embrace was nothing Fanning's mind could penetrate. As long as they stayed where they were, Fanning couldn't find them.
But he'll come, said Amy.
Carter nodded. He's bided his time a good while, but the man wants this thing done. It's what he's wanted from the start. Everything over.
The wind was picking up, an autumn wind, damp and raw. Clouds had moved in, denuding the light. It was the time of day when a certain silence always fell.
We're quite a pair, aren't we?
That we are, Miss Amy.
I was wondering if maybe you could drop the miss. I should have said that long ago.
I just meant it respectful. But as long as you're asking, I'd like that.
The leaves were spinning down. They fluttered across the lawn, the patio, the pool deck, tossing in the wind like skeletal hands. Amy thought of Peter. How she missed him. Wherever he was now, she hoped that happiness would find him in his life. That was the price she'd paid. She had given him up. She took a last sip of tea to clear the blood taste from her mouth and drew on her gloves.
Ready?
Right you are. Carter donned his hat. We best get to work on them leaves.
8. Michael! His sister took her last two steps at a jog and wrapped him in a hug that made his ribs crunch.
Whoa, I'm glad to see you too.
The nurse at the desk was staring at them, but Sarah couldn't be contained.
I can't believe it, she said. What are you doing here?
She stepped back and looked him over with a motherly eye. One part of him felt embarrassed. Another part would have been disappointed if she hadn't.
God, you're thin. When did you get here? Kate will be thrilled.
She glanced at the nurse, an older woman in a boiled smock.
Wendy, this is my brother Michael.
The one with the sailboat? He laughed. That's me. Please tell me you're staying, Sarah said. Just a couple of days. She shook her head and sighed.
I guess I'll have to take what I can get.
She was clutching his upper arm as if he might float away. I'm off in an hour. Don't go anywhere, okay? I know you, Michael. I mean it. He waited for her, and together they walked to the apartment. How odd it was to be back on dry land, with its disconcerting stillness underfoot. After 3 years mostly alone, the hum of so much packed humanity felt like something scraping his skin. He did his best to conceal his agitation, believing it would pass, though he also wondered if his time at sea had wrought a fundamental change in his temperament that would bar him from ever living among people again. With a stab of guilt, he noted how much Kate had changed. The baby in her was gone. Even her curls had straightened. The two of them played go-to with Hollis while Sarah made supper. When dinner was over, Michael got into bed with her to tell her a story. Not a story from a book. Kate demanded something from real life, a tale of his adventures at sea. He chose the story of the whale. This was something that had happened about 6 months before, far out in the Gulf. It was late at night, the water calm and gleaming beneath a full moon, when his boat began to lift, as if the sea were rising. A dark bulge emerged off his port side. At first he didn't know what it was. He had read about whales, but never seen one, and his sense of such a creature's dimensions was vague, even disbelieving. How could something so big be alive? As the whale slowly breached the surface, a spout of water shot from its head. The creature rolled lazily onto its side, one massive flipper lifting clear. Its flanks, shiny and black, were encrusted with barnacles. Michael was too amazed to be afraid. Only later did it occur to him that with one slap of its tail, the whale could have shattered his boat to pieces. Kate was staring at him, wide-eyed.
What happened?
Well, Michael went on, that was the funny thing. He had expected the whale to move on, but it didn't. For nearly an hour, it ran alongside the Nautilus. Occasionally, it would duck its enormous head beneath the surface, only to reappear a few moments later with a spout from its blowhole, like a big wet sneeze. Then, as the moon was setting, the creature descended and did not reappear. Michael waited. Was it finally gone? Several minutes passed. He began to relax. Then, with an explosion of seawater, it reared upward off his starboard bow, hurling its massive body high into the air. It was, Michael said, like watching a city lift into the sky. See what I can do? Don't mess with me, brother. It crashed back down with a second detonation that blasted him broadside and left him drenched. He never saw it again. Kate was smiling. I get it. He was playing a joke on you. Michael laughed. I guess maybe he was. He kissed her goodnight and returned to the main room, where Hollis and Sarah were putting up the last of the dishes. The power had been cut for the night. A pair of candles flickered on the table, exuding greasy trails of smoke. She's quite a kid. Hollis gets the credit, Sarah said. I'm so busy at the hospital I sometimes feel like I barely see her. Hollis grinned. It's true. I hope a mat on the floor is all right, Sarah said. If I'd known you were coming, I could have gotten a proper cot from the hospital. Are you kidding? I usually sleep sitting up. I'm not even sure I actually sleep anymore. Sarah was wiping down the stove with a cloth, a little too aggressively. Michael could sense her frustration. It was an old conversation. Look, Michael said, you don't have to worry about me. I'm fine. Sarah exhaled sharply. Hollis, talk to him. I know I won't get anywhere. The man shrugged helplessly. What do you want me to say? How about people love you? Stop trying to get yourself killed. It's not like that, Michael said. What Sarah is trying to say, Hollis interjected, is we all hope you're being careful. No, that's not at all what I'm saying. She looked at Michael. Is it Lore? Is that the reason? Lore has nothing to do with it. Then tell me, because I'd really like to understand this, Michael. How should he explain himself? His reasons were so tangled together that they weren't anything he could assemble into an argument. It just feels right. That's all I can say. She resumed her overzealous scrubbing. So you feel like you should be scaring the hell out of me. Michael reached for her, but she shook him away. Sarah, don't. She refused to look at him. Don't tell me this is okay. Don't tell me any of this is okay. God damn it, I told myself I wouldn't do this. I have to get up early. Hollis moved in behind her. He placed one hand on her shoulder, the other on the rag, bringing it to a halt and gently taking it from her hand. We've talked about this. You've got to let him be. Oh, listen to you. You probably think it's just great. Sarah had begun to cry. Hollis turned her around and drew her into him. He looked past her shoulder at Michael, who was standing awkwardly by the table. She's just worn out, is all. Maybe you could give us a minute? Sure, yeah. Thank you, Michael. The key's right by the door. Michael let himself out of the apartment and exited the complex. With nowhere to go, he took a seat on the ground near the entrance where nobody would bother him. He hadn't felt this bad in a long time. Sarah had always been a worrier, but he didn't like upsetting her. It was one of the reasons he came to the city so rarely. He would have liked to make her happy, find someone to marry, settle down with a job just like everybody else, have kids. His sister deserved some peace of mind after all she'd done, stepping in to look after him when their parents had died, though she'd just been a kid herself. Everything they did and said to each other contained this unspoken fact. If things had happened differently, they might have been just like any other brother and sister, their importance to one another fading over time as new connections took precedence. But not the two of them. New people would take the stage. but there would always be a room in their hearts in which only the two of them resided. When he felt like he'd waited a suitable time, he returned to the apartment. The candles were doused. Sarah had left a mat and pillow for him. He undressed in the dark and lay down. Only then did he notice the note that Sarah had propped on his pack. He lit a candle and read.
"I'm sorry. I love you. All eyes. S."
Just 3 sentences, but they were all he needed. They were the same 3 sentences that the two of them had been saying to each other every day of their lives. He awoke to see Kate's face just inches from his own.
"Uncle Michael, wake up!"
He drew himself up on his elbows. Hollis was standing by the door. "Sorry, I told her to leave you alone." It took Michael a moment to gather himself. He wasn't used to sleeping so late. He wasn't used to sleeping at all.
"Is Sarah here?"
"Gone for hours." He beckoned to his daughter. "Let's go. We're going to be late." Kate rolled her eyes.
"Daddy's scared of the sisters."
"Your daddy's a smart man. Those ladies make my insides twist."
"Michael," said Hollis, "you're not helping."
"Right." He looked at the girl.
"Do as your daddy says, sweetheart."
Kate surprised him with a sudden, forceful hug.
"Will you be here when I get back?"
"Sure I will." He listened to their footsteps descending the stairs. You had to hand it to the kid. Pure emotional blackmail. But what could he do? He dressed and washed up at the sink. Sarah had left rolls for breakfast, but he wasn't really hungry. He could find something later if he needed to, assuming he actually felt like eating. He grabbed his pack and headed out. Sarah was finishing her morning rounds when one of the nurses fetched her. She made her way to the reception area to find Sister Peg standing at the desk.
"Sister, hello."
Sister Peg was one of those people who changed any room she entered, tightening every screw. Her age was anybody's guess. At least 60, though it was said that she'd looked exactly the same for 20 years. A figure of legendary cantankerousness, though Sarah knew better. Beneath the stern exterior was a woman devoted completely to the children in her care.
"Might I have a word with you, Sarah?"
Moments later, they were headed to the orphanage. As they drew near, Sarah could hear the whoops and cries of children. Morning recess was in full swing. They entered through the garden gate.
"Dr. Sarah! Dr. Sarah!"
Sarah didn't make it 5 steps onto the playground before the children descended. They knew her well, but part of their excitement, she understood, was the presence of any visitor. She extricated herself with promises to stay longer next time and followed Sister Peg into the building. The girl was sitting on the table in the little room Sarah used for exams. Her eyes flicked up as Sarah entered. She could have been 12 or 13. It was difficult to tell through the layers of filth. She was wearing a grimy burlap frock, knotted over one shoulder. Her feet, blackened with dirt and covered with scabs, were bare. "Domestic security brought her in late last night," Sister Peg said. "She hasn't spoken a word." The girl had been caught trying to break into an ag storehouse. Sarah could see why. She looked half-starved.
"Hello. I'm Dr. Sarah. Can you tell me your name?"
The girl, peering intently at Sarah from under the hood of her matted hair, gave no reply. Her eyes, the only part of her body that had moved since Sarah entered the room, darted to Sister Peg, then back at Sarah. "We tried to find out who her parents are," Sister Peg said, "but there's no record of anybody looking for her." Sarah guessed there wouldn't be. She removed her stethoscope from her bag and showed the girl.
"I'm going to listen to your heart. Would that be okay?"
No words. Yet the girl's eyes said she could. Sarah slid the knotted side of the frock from her shoulder. She was thin as a reed, but her breasts had just begun to show. At the feel of the cold disc on her skin, the girl flinched slightly, but that was all. Sarah, you should look at this. Sister Peg was staring at the girl's back. It was covered with burns and lash marks. Some were old, others still weeping. Sarah had seen it before, but never like this. She looked at the girl. Honey, can you tell me who did this to you? I don't think she can talk, Sister Peg said. Sarah had begun to grasp the situation. The girl allowed Sarah to hold her chin. Sarah moved her other hand beside the girl's right ear. She snapped her fingers 3 times. The girl did not react. She swapped hands to test the other ear. Nothing. Looking into the girl's eyes, Sarah then pointed to her own ear and slowly shook her head, meaning no. The girl nodded. That's because she's deaf. Then a surprising thing happened. The girl reached for Sarah's hand. With her index finger, she began to draw a series of lines in Sarah's upturned palm. Not lines, Sarah realized. Letters. P. I. M. Pim, Sarah said. She glanced at Sister Peg, then looked back at the girl. Pim, is that your name? She nodded. Sarah took the girl's palm. Sarah, she wrote, and pointed at herself. Sarah. She looked up. Sister, can you get me something to write with? Sister Peg departed the room, returning moments later with one of the handheld chalkboards the children used for their lessons. Where are your parents? Sarah wrote. Pim took the board. She erased Sarah's words with her palm, then gripped the chalk awkwardly in her fist. Dead. When? Mom, then Dad, long time. Who hurt you? Man. What man? Don't know, got away. The next question pained her, but it had to be asked. Did he hurt you anywhere else? The girl hesitated, then nodded. Sarah's heart sank. Where? Pim took the board. Girl place. Without taking her eyes off the girl, Sarah said, Sister, can you give us a minute? When Sister Peg was gone, Sarah wrote, More than once? The girl nodded. Need to look. We'll be careful. Pim's whole body clenched. She shook her head vigorously back and forth. Please, wrote Sarah. Have to make sure you are okay. Pim took the chalkboard and quickly scribbled, My fault, promised not to tell. No, not your fault. Pim, bad. Sarah didn't know if she wanted to cry or be sick. She'd seen some things in her life, terrible things, and not just at the homeland. You couldn't walk the hospital halls without encountering the worst of human nature. A woman with a broken wrist and an excuse about falling down a flight of stairs, reciting how it had happened while her husband looked on, coaching her with his eyes. An old man with advanced malnutrition dumped at the door by relatives. One of Dunk's whores, her body ravaged with disease and misuse, clutching a fistful of Austin's to rid herself of the baby she was carrying so she could get back on the stool. You hardened your heart because there was no other way to get through the day. But the children were the worst. The children you couldn't look away from. In Pim's case, it wasn't hard to reconstruct the story. Her parents dead. Somebody had offered to take the girl in, a family member or neighbor, everyone thinking how kind and generous that person was, to assume responsibility for this poor orphan who couldn't hear or talk. And after that, nobody had bothered to check. No, honey, no.
Sarah took Pim's hands and looked into her eyes. There was a soul in there, tiny, terrified, discarded by the world. There wasn't anybody more alone on the face of the earth. And Sarah understood what was being asked of her, just for being human. Not even Hollis knew the story. It wasn't that Sarah was afraid to tell him. She knew the kind of man he was. But silence was a decision she'd made long ago. At the homeland, it was said, everybody had taken their turn. And Sarah's had come in due course. She had endured it as best she knew how. And when it was over, she imagined a box made of steel with a strong lock. Then she took the memory and put it in the box. She took the board and wrote, "Somebody hurt me there once, too." The girl studied the board with the same guarded expression. Perhaps 10 seconds passed. She took up the chalk again. "Secret? You are the only person I ever told." The girl's face was changing. Something was letting go. Sarah wrote, "We are the same. Sarah is good. Pim is good. Not our fault." A film of tears appeared in the surface of the girl's eyes. A single drop edged over the barrier and spilled down her cheek, cutting a river in the dirt. Her lips were closed. The muscles of her neck and jaw grew taut, then began to quiver. A strange new sound entered the room. It was a kind of growl, like an animal's. It felt like something fighting to get out. And then it did. The girl opened her mouth and released a howl that seemed to shatter the very idea of human language, distilling it to a single, sustained vowel of pain. Sarah wrapped her in a tight embrace. Pim was wailing, shaking, fighting to break free, but Sarah wouldn't let her. "It's all right," she said. "I won't let you go. I won't let you go." And she held her that way until the girl was quiet again. And for a long time after. 9. The Capitol building, housed in what had once been Texas First Trust Bank, the name was still engraved in the building's limestone fascia, was just a short walk from the school. A directory in the lobby listed the various departments: Housing Authority, Public Health, Agriculture and Commerce, Printing and Engraving. Sanchez's office was located on the second floor. Peter ascended the stairs, which opened onto a second open area with a desk, behind which sat a domestic security officer in an unnaturally clean uniform. Peter felt suddenly embarrassed to be dressed in his ratty work clothes, carrying a bag full of rattling tools and nails.
"Help you?"
"I'm here to see President Sanchez. I have an appointment."
"Name?"
His eyes had returned to his desk. He was filling out some kind of form. "Peter Jackson." It was like a light going on in the man's face.
"You're Jackson?"
Peter dipped his head.
"Holy smokes."
The man just sat there, awkwardly staring. It had been some time since Peter had gotten this kind of reaction. On the other hand, he rarely met anybody new these days. Never, in fact.
"Maybe you could let somebody know," Peter said finally.
"Right." The officer popped from his chair. "Just a second. I'll tell them you're here." Peter noted the word "them." Who else would be attending the meeting? For that matter, why was he here at all? In the hours of mulling over the president's note, he'd come up empty. Maybe it was just as Caleb had suggested, and they really did want him back in the army. If so, it was going to be a short conversation.
"You can come right back, Mr. Jackson."
The officer took Peter's tool bag and led him down a long hallway. Sanchez's door was open. She rose from behind her desk as Peter entered.
a small woman with mostly white hair, sharp features, and a strong gaze. A second person, a man with a tight, bristly beard, was seated across.